This is On The Tee Golf New Zealand Podcast, hosted by Tom Hyde and Brendan Telfer. Proudly presented by Podcasts New Zealand and Gorilla Voice Media.
Well, hello again and welcome to On The Tee. Here we talk only golf and we try to kind of put a New Zealand slant on golf as well. I'm Brendan Telfer, here with my co-host Tom Hyde. And we come to you in association with our friends from JK's World of Golf out there at Auckland International Airport, open 24-7, and the Akarana Golf Club, which has some great deals just 10 minutes from the airport and 10 minutes from the Auckland CBD. Check out some of these deals at akaranagolf.co.nz. Well, our guest today is Ryan Fox, New Zealand's top-ranked golfer, who unfortunately, because of the pandemic, has been seriously inhibited from playing as regularly as he would like on the European Tour in 2021 so far this year. I think Ryan's only managed three starts, and all of them in the Middle East, back-to-back in the month of February and into March. Then back home and straight into managed quarantine, of course, and then straight out of quarantine and straight into Auckland's lockdown three. So, Ryan, nice to have you with us again here on the tee. I don't imagine you're terribly enamored anymore with this pandemic. Like most of us, you're probably sick to death of it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, obviously, with what I do, travel is very important, and travel's really, really hard at the moment, especially coming in and out of New Zealand. I mean, obviously, I know we're in a good place COVID-wise, but yeah, it certainly makes it hard from my point of view coming back and doing quarantine every time, and it sort of makes going over, you know, makes the decision to go overseas pretty tough. You know, you've got to weigh up, is it worth going? You know, I've got to play enough events or big enough events to make it worthwhile. You feel a little bit of pressure on out of those events, or with those events, obviously, because you know, you kind of want to get the most out of a trip. And then, you know, there's also the you're slightly worried if any trips are cancelled or any flights are cancelled or anything like that. You know, there's obviously a lot of demand for MIQ spots at the moment, and you know, I was looking at that back from Saudi and a bit worried about things, and if I'd have missed a flight the next time I could have got back into New Zealand, I think, was May.
Extraordinary. So what are they laid on the organisers in Saudi laid on a private plane to get you to Dubai or somewhere, did they?
Yeah, it was kind of a funny one. I mean, Saudi was probably the one place we were going to get a flight out of regardless. I know there was a couple of the big guys jumping on private planes back to Dubai, but they ended up, one of their main sponsors was Saudi, the Saudi Airlines. So, you know, they managed, there was a Saudi flight at 6 p.m. that was, I'd booked myself on, and if it had gone as normal, I probably would have missed that flight. Then all of a sudden that got cancelled, but, you know, on the Tuesday or Wednesday they sort of told us, look, it's going to come back at some level as a charter flight or something like that. And we didn't actually get confirmation until Saturday afternoon that the Saudi flight is going at 7 o'clock, and even if, you know, you win or you're in the last couple of groups and it's going to be tight to get it, we will make sure you get on that plane.
And so what, you hop basically then straight on a plane back here from Dubai?
Yeah, I had, I think, 6 or 7 hours in Dubai overnight in a hotel. And then, yeah, jumped on a plane on Monday morning. It's probably almost the most nervous I've been getting to an airport and making sure that I got on, you know, got everywhere early, didn't mess around at the gate, you know, just, you know, was completely studious for want of a better word. Made sure I managed to get on that flight and nothing happened.
Just to be clear, why would you not be able to come back until May? What were you told?
Well, I mean, from what I've been told, we have no preferential treatment as athletes, which you know, compared to a lot of the rest of the world, is very frustrating. And so when I'd looked, the next available date on MIQ was, I think, the 11th or 12th of May.
So the problem was back here.
Yeah. The problem wasn't and, you know, I'd hope, you know, because when I booked the flights, there was a flight, an 8 or a 9 p.m. Emirates flight out of Saudi, but then all the Emirates flights in and out of Saudi got cancelled the week we were there. I would have hoped we would have been able to get some kind of help, but, you know, there's enough stories going around of, you know, people not being able to,
you know,
find
spots. We've been talking about this, Brendan, about preference. I mean, I'm all in favor of preference to athletes, you know, who are out there representing New Zealand. What's your view on that?
We were talking about this yesterday in our previous podcast with John Hart about he's had a problem as a director of the Blues getting an Argentinian prop they wanted to come and play for the Blues in this Super Rugby season, which is now underway. And he apparently was the only player that any of the five franchises wanted to recruit. So it wasn't like there was going to be a stampede if they gave permission for one player. None of the other franchises wanted anyone, but they still wouldn't bend the rules to allow this one Argentinian player come in. And that seemed a bit tough. I mean, I have an issue with my daughter who's living in Sydney, and her partner's here in New Zealand, and he came home before Christmas. She can't now get back here till May, and she's living on her own in Sydney, and she's not particularly happy about it, but there's nothing she can do. But she doesn't have any preferential treatment as well. But I suppose from the government's point of view, someone has suggested that they build, an epidemiologist suggested they build a 6,000-room centre out of Auckland, somewhere out in the country, away from the metropolitan areas. But the cost is horrific, and presumably in 12 months' time, it might be empty.
You certainly hope so for the world's sake.
And then the other interesting twist I'm hearing on this as well is that this is just idle political speculation maybe. One of the reasons why this bubble with Australia is not coming to the fore is because New Zealand motels are full of homeless people, and that where do you put all these homeless people if suddenly the tourist numbers start arriving in New Zealand from Australia? So the government...
No place for them.
No place for them. So it's a mess whichever way you look at it.
I mean, personally, from my point of view, I kind of find it frustrating. I get why they want to advise people against not travelling. But, you know, in my line of work, I don't have a choice. If I don't travel, I don't have a job. And there's a lot of other athletes in the same boat. And, you know, you can imagine, you know, there won't be too many people each week, you know, trying to get a spot to come back. And high-performance sport have been pretty good in the lead-up to the Olympics. You know, we've been told that we could book it a long way in advance, but that sort of didn't help me much in terms of I wasn't probably planning on, if I go overseas, I'm not planning on coming back before the Olympics. And B, our schedule is, even though it's, you know, on the website you can see it, it's certainly not set in stone with all the...
What about if you were to get a vaccination now? Would that help you?
Well, I've been told from a European point of view, 100%. So I have had a couple of chats with the tour around, you know, our travel issues in New Zealand and stuff like that. And, you know, one of the guys has said to me, you know, it's not going to be mandatory to have a vaccine, but it's certainly going to be beneficial.
But again, I guess you're not going to get any special treatment here in New Zealand, are you?
Well, I think that looks a little more positive than what the quarantine was looking like. You know, it may change in quarantine, and hopefully it does. But, you know, there's obviously a lot of stuff going on in the media, and I haven't heard anything personally, but you hear about the Black Caps potentially getting it to be able to do the Test Championship in June. And there has been talk even early on with the vaccine that, you know, Olympic athletes.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's a lot of, about now in Olympic year, large numbers of athletes have been already named and chosen, yourself as an example. But our rowers, always about now at the end of the rowing season in New Zealand, go off to Europe to compete in a number of pre-Olympic regattas. Whether they're doing it this time or not. I mean, if they don't, they'll be seriously disadvantaged when they get to the Olympics. So you think, well, give them a vaccine. How long does it take to vaccinate, you know, 30 rowers?
It should not be nothing, really.
So there is a growing sense of frustration around it. There's both the vaccine and, I suppose, the quarantine, which is understandable. But I think getting the vaccines out, I don't know why we're not vaccinating more people more quickly. I look at the numbers of Australia, who started a day or two after we did, and they're up to 180,000 or something.
Well, the UK's got 30 million.
Yeah, 30 million.
I mean, they've been a shambles the whole way through, but they've managed
to come right with a vaccination. I mean, so could you get a vaccination when you get there?
I don't know, to be honest. I mean, I know there's a lot of places around the world now you can buy the vaccination. Even when we're in Dubai this year, you could see we drove past a couple of the vaccination centres where you could buy it, and I think it was something silly like $1,000 US a shot, and the lines were 2.5-3 hours long to get it. And I don't know what vaccine it was either. But
something made in Siberia. You see.
But more than likely, probably.
Let me going back to Saudi, Ryan. You know, I've always understood Saudi Arabia being one of the most difficult countries in the world to get into. And the things have liberalized a bit, especially with the golf. So when you go there to play, you know, it used to be a 30-day wait for a visa, that kind of thing. What was the process? How do they handle professional golf now in terms of visas and entry and the whole flow of the business?
So they've made the visa process a lot easier. It's just online now. You don't have to do any.
For everybody?
So I think they're pushing.
Because they're pushing tourism,
yeah,
aren't they?
From what I've heard, and again, it's probably that political speculation, that they want to be Dubai.
Yeah.
Obviously not the excess that Dubai has, but they want to be able to generate the tourists that Dubai has. Mm. And I mean, they have a phenomenal coastline along that Red Sea.
Yeah. Looks good.
So obviously there's a few things that are still pretty tough for tourists. But they've made it easier in terms of the visas to get there.
Yeah.
And for us, we count as that. I mean, I didn't do the visa personally. It's one benefit of having a management company, and I just get an email saying, here's your visa, take a printed copy of it, and you just go straight in. And
I mean, allowing for the COVID and the difficulty for everybody for traveling, my experience in living in Dubai for 5 years was that the people who played the golf courses were not tourists and were not Emiratis. They were expats living in Dubai and Abu Dhabi. And so when there wasn't a tournament on, like the Abu Dhabi Championship HSB, some of the courses just weren't busy. They weren't, you could walk on. How did you find that in Saudi, that the courses you played, was there a lot of golf being played outside of
it? Not really, from what I understand. I mean, the golf course we play in Saudi is fantastic. You could chuck it anywhere in the world, and I think it's probably the best golf course we play out of the three in the Middle East at the start of the year.
Okay.
And a fair bit of that probably has to do with no one ever playing it, really.
Hmm.
And again, it's the same thing. You know, it's mainly expats. I don't think there's too many Saudi nationals that play golf. I think it's getting a bit more popular. But, it's certainly – I mean,
well, did you hear that Jack Nicklaus is building a course there now?
Have you read about that?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, Nicklaus has been hired by Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, to build this course. And it's this, they've got this incredible entertainment come like Disneyland being built 40 miles out of Riyadh. Have you read about this at all?
I think I've legitimately been there, I think.
It begins with Q, and I can't pronounce it because it's Arabic. But it's roller coasters, it's fun parks, and a Nicklaus golf course. And again, the push for tourism. So my question, Ryan, from your experience playing around the world, maybe you don't get a picture of it because you play and you come and go and you're traveling. But, you know, does golf really promote tourism? Would people travel to Saudi Arabia or the Middle East even just to play golf? Or is the connection between golf and tourism overblown?
I mean, if you look around the world, I think golf and tourism is massive. I mean, you look at how many people – I won't use the Middle East so much, but you look at Scotland, or we did Tasmania a couple of years ago, Ballinbogle with a few mates.
Hawaii.
I mean, a lot of the east coast of the States.
Mm-hmm.
The list goes on. So golf tourism Queenstown's the perfect example here. Mm-hmm. Queenstown wants to turn itself into an international golf destination.
Yeah.
And I think – There's all the pieces there for the Middle East to do it. The only thing that hurts them is the weather. You know, it's
hard as hell.
I don't think it's not marketed for us down here. But if you look at Europe, if you're sitting in Europe in December and January and it's freezing cold and you can't go outside, and even if you could play golf, you don't want to because it's too wet.
Good point.
You can fly to Dubai. It's 25 degrees.
Mm.
There's a lot of great golf courses to play.
You get there in 4 hours.
And Saudi could be that in 10 years. I mean, as I said, that course we play – in Jeddah or in King Abdullah Economic City, as it is, it's about an hour north of Jeddah. It would travel anywhere in the world and be a good golf course.
Well, I guess what they're doing, Tom, again, using the Dubai example, isn't it? You put the fun parlour in there, part of the family attraction, along with the golf course.
Right.
Dad can play at the golf course. Mum and the kids go off to the Disney World Dubai or Disney World Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
So I guess that's what they're trying to replicate in Saudi over the next 10 years.
But if you look at Queenstown as well, I mean, like, you can play the hills or Millbrook or whatever and have the TV cameras there. And that's – even if you're not a golfer, that promotes Queenstown. I mean, all you have to do is see 30 seconds of that on TV and go, this place looks pretty awesome. I might want to go and visit that. You know, and I think that's what Saudi's trying to do. You know, that they've got a great – that great coastline up the Red Sea. And, I mean, some of the views we had on TV and on the golf course there are pretty spectacular. You know, it's the same stuff you get in – and some of the islands and, you know, the Pacific Islands.
And so were you in this kind of tour bubble in Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, the whole – the 3 weeks in the Middle East were in a full bubble, same as last year. Actually, the testing's worse now because most countries are requiring an exit test or an entry test. To go – my process for 3 weeks, I got tested twice here before I left, once to get into Dubai, and I wasn't sure if my – Dubai test would carry into Abu Dhabi, even though it's the same country. There's a land border there. So I got tested the Friday before I left, the Sunday I left to make sure I could get through the land border to Abu Dhabi. And then I was tested when I arrived in the tournament at 9 o'clock on Monday morning. I tested on Sunday of Abu Dhabi to get back to Dubai, and that counted as to get into the tournament bubble in Dubai. I had to test on the Sunday of Dubai to get to Saudi, landed in Saudi at 10 o'clock on Monday night. I got to the hotel at 10 o'clock on Monday night, tested straight away, and then tested Sunday morning before I left.
How's your nasal passage?
And then there's three tests back here because I flew through Dubai. They've now got the day zero testing. So I think it was 9 tests in
So that explains the hole in your nose that we're looking at.
Well, there is talk of this mouth swab, isn't it?
Yeah.
Coming on.
So I'd be a big advocate for that because I think I'm in the 20s of COVID tests and they don't get any better the more you do.
Oh, no. Anyway, while we're speaking about Saudi Arabia, talk to us about the tournament there. You finished sixth and you had a round with the third round where you played
third
with
round
Dustin
with DJ,
Johnson. And I notice, speaking as a proud Kiwi back here watching it on television, I was delighted to see that you were matching him. There's not many golfers on any tour can match Dustin Johnson off the tee, but you were.
Yeah, I had a couple past him that day.
Did he have anything to say?
A second time I played with him, and a couple of times he said good drive, but we found a pretty common interest in fishing, so we pretty much just talked fishing the whole way around the golf course, which was quite nice.
Is it impressive to watch, this guy?
It's just golf so easy, and he just doesn't care. I the best way to describe it, and excuse my language, he just doesn't give a shit. Legitimately just doesn't care. He gets up and goes, I've got to hit it here. And if he doesn't hit it there, I go, well, I'm going to hit the next one. And on, I think, 13 that day, it was a little into the sun. You couldn't really see your second shot that well, pretty glary. And he hit it, and he must have just cut it up into the wind. It landed on the bank, short right of the green, a couple of bounces into the water. And he, walking down the fairway, looks at me, goes, did you see mine? I was like, I think it bounced on the hill and bounced into the water. And there was no reaction. Not even a, oh, damn. You know, it was...
So what?
Made six.
Yeah, I've been told, though, that he's one of the best total athletes on tour, that he could have played professional baseball, or he's a good hoops player. He can do a lot of different things, and maybe this golf thing to him is just comes like so natural that he plays without the stress that all of us have experienced at some stage, certainly. I don't know. I mean,
I'm waiting to see Johnson paired with Bryson DeChambeau in the last round of a major championship and see these two go together head to head.
I think it'll honestly have way less effect on DJ than it has on most of the other guys because he legitimately doesn't – just nothing phases him.
Yeah, you know, on that note, playing with him, I was down to this memorial tournament at Springfield. I played in for a mate who passed away years ago, and another athlete played rugby for Bay of Plenty. And the kid who won the tournament received an autographed ball that I think you were instrumental in – setting up. I know maybe you won't remember that, but
no,
you don't?
Not at this point.
Oh, well, maybe there's something going on here. We should investigate, because there was a Dustin Johnson autographed ball, and they said, oh, Ryan Fox set this up for us.
Was that a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah. So a good mate of mine. Yeah, sorry, I got confused there. I thought you were talking about my signature.
And No.
Dustin's. So one of my good mates I went to school with, it was his old man's charity tournament.
Okay.
And he messaged me before.
The Cowley, one of the Cowleys?
Richard Cowley.
Richard. Yep. Oh, yeah. I met Richard. So, Sarah Cowley is the sister. Was at the pentathlete?
Pentathlete.
That's where. So Rich messaged me, and he's like, oh, we've got my old man's golf day on the
26th. Correct. Yeah, who's a mate of mine, Jerry Cowley.
Yeah. I never actually met Jerry. So Jerry passed away, unfortunately, the year Rich and I started school. We're going to go on a cricket tour to Australia, and my dad and his and Jerry were going to play a bit of golf together.
Okay.
And unfortunately, Jerry never made it to the cricket tour. But I've stayed good mates with Rich since school. I mean, that's 15 years ago now.
Well, there's a nice gesture because
I was supposed to have
my charity fishing and golf thing down in Waihee.
Yeah.
And I played with DJ on Saturday and Rosie on Sunday, and DJ loves his fishing and Rosie's into his fishing as well. And I said, hey guys, I got a charity event, just after the round, would you mind signing something? DJ signed a couple of balls and Rosie signed a ball and a glove. And when Rich messaged me, say, would you mind signing a couple of hats, I was like, well, I've got a DJ signed ball if you want to take that down. And he said, yes, certainly. So that's where that came from.
It was a nice gesture. It was appreciated. You know, I had to look at it and say, man, this is really cool. It was really cool.
His writing's ridiculously neat, too. You can actually read it.
Yeah, that's right, actually. It's very scripted, you know? It's nice.
So he won, didn't he? He won by a couple of shots.
He won by a couple, and he cruised it. I mean, I don't think he putted overly well. And
so from your point of view, you went into those three tournaments cold, I guess, really.
Completely cold.
And you made the cut in the first two.
I bogeyed the last at Abu Dhabi to miss the cut.
Did you? Oh, okay. So you were a bit rusty. Were you surprised that, given the quality of that field in Saudi, that you ran so deep into the field?
I mean, yes and no. Obviously, it was very rusty the first week in Abu Dhabi, and I hit it quite nice and putted terribly, which seems to be a trend every now and again. But I sort of mentally felt a bit more comfortable, like the more events I'd played. And you know, Dubai, there was a lot of, I think I was second or third in the field for birdie production for the week. I just made a lot of silly mistakes. So it was all kind of there, and I'd played well around Saudi before, so it wasn't necessarily a surprise to play well, but it was probably a surprise to be up there for that long in that field, you know, and actually compete the whole time, you know, for not being in contention for quite a while for me, and you know, to get to play the weekend with number one player in the world and next number one in Rosie, and had a couple more putts, not graze the edge on the weekend, you know, I could have found four shots pretty easily.
But nonetheless, obviously it was a good pay packer, but also very valuable points, wasn't it, for this race to Dubai? That I think I looked at the other day, you were 47th or something, so you've got a bit of wriggle room, haven't you, even if you're not playing much?
Yeah, I mean, it was certainly nice to have a decent week, one of those three, not just for the money, not just money wise, but also, you know, the fact I don't know when I was kind of going to play next. Yeah. I mean, we played in Qatar last week, and there's two events in Kenya back to back, but you know, after coming out of quarantine and having a week and a half at home, I wasn't going to go away for 3 weeks again. So it was
so
nice.
When do you think you will play next on the European tour?
Maybe, I mean, earliest we're looking at going back is mid-May, but at this point, I mean, there's so many variables. Obviously the UK is in a looks like it's trending the right way in terms of the vaccine. Obviously having a little one at home, that you know, affects the decision making a little bit. You know, still talking to the tour about, you know, what the dealers or status and everything for next year, because you know, for a lot of the guys on tour, it's just as hard, or if not harder, to travel this year as it was last year. And you know, we had status rolled over last year, so we're just trying to.
So tell us a bit about that bubble last year. I see you played, I think, in 15 tournaments last year in Europe, most of them on European soil. I mean, you got off to a good start with that, I think, second or third finish at the Victorian Open. So what was life like traveling as one family bubble of 150 golfers from week to week?
Well, Well, it wasn't even that, to be honest. It was obviously everyone, we had to stay in the same place. So basically the process was you had tests to go in, as I said earlier, and then pretty much you had breakfast at the hotel, lunch and dinner, lunch at the golf course, dinner back in the hotel. You had no other option. There's generally one restaurant open.
And you couldn't go to a restaurant in town anyway?
You could not. If you left the bubble, you're disqualified.
Oh,
if you
okay.
had any contact with anyone outside the bubble, you're disqualified. Wow. And it was even that this year still. And if you had, if your caddy tested positive for COVID, you were out. You know, all of it was really, really strict.
Mm.
And they did. The only concession we got towards the end of last year, which stayed into this year, was you're allowed a buddy system. I think they were getting to a point where guys were completely losing the plot by themselves or just socialising with the caddy.
Mm.
So you're allowed to hang out with another player and his caddy for the week.
How did you handle all that psychologically?
I was all right. I mean, I was well over it by the time I got back at the back end of last year. I did 11 weeks out of 12 playing, and all of that was in a hotel room by myself. Yeah. So it's effectively, I did 12 weeks of half quarantine, basically. Mm-hmm. I mean,
do you have a caddy traveling with you?
Yeah. Yeah. But we didn't stay together at all. So,
Was he in the hotel?
Yeah, he was in the hotel. Yep, so, yep. We could have dinner every night. Yep. But again, the caddy-player relationship at times can be a stressful one.
Yeah, so you don't want to be socializing necessarily all the time with some guy that you're working with all day on the golf course.
Yeah, and, it's like being married at some level in that regard. So, there was a little bit of, it's nice to have dinner with someone, sometimes.
Now and again,
we were having socially distanced dinners, sitting 2 meters apart and yelling across tables. That's kind of what it was. You had to wear masks everywhere. It was, pretty much like quarantine.
And do you sense it's going to be much the same again this year?
To start with, I mean, obviously what we played in the Middle East was, I think what they've got in Qatar and Kenya are the same.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping by sort of May, June, when a significant population, or part of the population is vaccinated worldwide, it's going to help.
Two things are at work in Britain, aren't they? I mean, I was looking at the COVID-19 infection numbers yesterday and fatalities for Britain, and they were way down, very low, well under 100, I think, in terms of deaths yesterday in Britain. And this galloping rate of vaccination up to 30 million and now getting on to half the country. So if those two continue in those directions in a couple of months, Britain might be the best place in Europe to go to.
At this stage it will be.
As opposed to Italy or Germany or France or somewhere?
Yeah, I think the problem for us is we've sort of got a cap on how many events you can realistically run in the UK. And what do we have? I think we had 8 last year in the UK. And we're going to have looking like 8 this year at least, what's on the schedule. So, we're kind of hit our ceiling there. And so we still have to travel. So it's not going to be the UK that'll be the issue. It'll be the other countries that are potentially lagging behind. And if there's still travel restrictions going on. And, the UK obviously is aiming to be open come June. But you got to think, for them, they've obviously had a pretty tough road of it over the last year. Do they want to risk opening up fully travel wise just in case there's another variant or something come around and they're not sure? Hopefully that never happens, but at this stage things have changed so quickly over the last year, both for good and bad. It's just so hard to pick what's going to happen in 2 months' time.
Well, for now, though, you've qualified for the Open Championship.
Yep.
And that's Royal St. George?
Yep.
Have I got that right?
Yep.
So, and that'll be July. So you'll be, Ryan will be heading off in May and playing events in the UK as a build up to
And Europe. So there's a few around Europe in the lead up.
How do you find playing in front of empty stands and no spectators?
It's really weird.
Is it?
It's. In some ways, it's if you're playing bad, it's almost nicer because you don't have anyone to...
You're not embarrassing yourself in front of people.
Yeah, pretty much,
But, I would have thought that for most of you guys, certainly the guys at the top, but you might play your first 2 rounds most weeks in front of very few spectators, wouldn't you?
Yeah, it doesn't... there's always people around, and especially in the bigger events, but, you do... I think the bigger guys notice it more than
I think Rory McIlroy, for one, has talked about how difficult he's found to concentrate, and I guess it's reflected in some of the results he's having lately.
It's been brought up as well. You know, how many guys have won that and won big tournaments with no crowds? You know, and I'm not saying they wouldn't have won that tournament, but. You know, you throw 50,000 people out on a golf course, that atmosphere is completely different.
Yeah.
You know, that mentality is completely different. How much of effect would that have had on golf tournaments over the last year?
We just had the Players' Championship recently, and I noticed a lot of the interviews afterwards, all players were always making a point, even if the question wasn't asked of them, how much they enjoyed having some spectators back. It wasn't a full house, but the 17th there, you know, had a nice collection of a few thousand people.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good. I guess what the point is, some players, it's better for because they can think and concentrate and they're not distracted. Other players miss it because a gallery will lift them to.
Yeah,
I mean, depends on personalities, eh?
I think you've got to, you know, if you're playing at the top level, you've just got to get used to that. And obviously guys thrive on it, and it's either you thrive on it or you learn how to deal with it.
Hmm.
And over the last year, the guys that might have had issues dealing with it haven't had to do it, so I'm not saying it would have affected any tournament, but it's certainly it's quite hard to get used to playing in front of really big crowds, and I'm sure it'll be quite weird going back to it again. I can imagine the Open, if it's fully open this year.
Can we regress for a moment? You talk about when you first went on the tour playing in front of a big crowd. I can remember players talking about playing with Tiger for the first time and how that was intimidating. Do you remember the biggest crowd you played in front of and how that affected your game and your approach?
Yeah, the first one I properly played in front of was the last group at the Aussie Open in 2015 or 2016 at Royal Sydney. We played with Jordan Spieth. And he was the defending champion there. Obviously, he'd won a couple of majors in the previous couple of years. And Royal Sydney's narrow. It's claustrophobic as it is. And we were lined both sides 7 or 8 deep the whole day. And I played great. I finished one shot out of the playoff. I didn't have any, but I know the first tee standing there going, well, this is a little bit different. And it's, I think for me, it was more a worry of hitting people. You know, obviously my ball generally travels at a little bit of speed. Not that, I mean, a golf ball off driver generally just travels at a bit of speed. This sounds bad, but sort of once you hit a couple of people, you just,
terrible feeling.
It's a bad feeling, but you also get to a point, well, I'm not trying to hit anyone. If I was watching golf personally, there's no way I'd stand between 250 and 300 yards out on the edge of the fairway.
I mean, you look at that tee shot of Bryson DeChambeau's last week on one of those early holes.
Yeah.
And even 80 yards from the tee could have been dangerous as he's hit the ball along the ground. But
It's when you're playing in front of just a big crowd, it's just hard to get used to the noise and then, that, or what happens if I hit anyone once you do it a few times and then even you hit a ball into someone and they're not hurt, it kind of makes you feel a bit better. And I've hit plenty of people over the years and none of which are intentional.
You give them a glove?
Yep, glove, have a bit of a chat.
I always find that quite ironic.
Yeah.
Poor guy's cringing and groaning with pain and some guy comes up, mate, have a glove.
There's nothing. Well, I've thankfully never hit anyone sort of
badly.
I've hit one marshal really hard at the World Cup of Golf a couple of years ago, and it was he was sitting in the trees, couldn't see anything. There was no crowd down there, signaled left, and the poor guy's just sitting on a chair, and it's hit him square in the top of the head, and he
on the fly
about 4 stitches, I think.
Oh,
yeah.
And we found out, I had a chat to him, signed gloves, signed ball, he was fine. He got stitched up, talked to the tournament organiser the next day. I was going to try to get him something, bottle of wine or something. She's like, no, he was fine. He went back out and walked the golf course. He enjoyed watching the golf, and it's got a bit of a story. Yeah. So I was like, okay, well, thankfully I didn't do any real damage.
Probably dine out on it for years. Okay, so some good things in your life. You're back in New Zealand, back with your family for a longer time than you probably had for many years, and you've got a wee addition into the family as well. So I suppose there's a bit of an upside as well to COVID.
Yes, certainly. I mean, I've had 3. I'll end up end up having three lots of sort of 3 months at home, which I don't know when the last time I would have had 3 months continuously at home was, let alone three of that in a year. So obviously it's a little frustrating in terms of the golf side of things, but you know, it's great. Obviously, we have a 3 month. We've got a 3 month old right now. I think she's 3 months old tomorrow. So
yeah, congratulations!
Thank you.
Has she changed your life?
Yeah, I mean, you got to be a little bit more organized now. That's for sure. You know, everything's a little bit harder, but she's been really good. She's sleeping through the night, thankfully. So, we're pretty lucky in that regard. And obviously, mum's been very supportive of what I do for.
And so mum and daughter will go with you back to Europe?
I mean, we're still making the decision on that, but that is the ultimate plan. I mean, probably the one hiccup for that is in the last year we haven't been able to have anyone go to tournaments. So it's going to it'll be hard to take them up to London and sit in a flat in London for 6 months while I'll travel around and play golf. So that's sort of our discussions around the tour as well. You know, if I bring the family up, we're obviously losing our support here. You know, and if they can't come to the events, it's not worth it. So hopefully in a month's time or, you know, whatever, I'll have a bit more clarity on what's going on there and might be able to make that decision a little bit easier.
Well, while you're back, are you playing more golf or doing more fishing?
Definitely playing more golf. It's a little easier to disappear for 4 hours and play golf than it is to disappear for a whole day on the on the ocean. I managed to get out on Sunday for the first time properly since the little one was born, which was nice.
Did you catch anything?
I got a nice kingfish, which was good. I'll definitely get out a few more times. I mean, it's the first couple of months are probably the hardest. So now that she's doing really well and mum's all right at home, I probably don't feel quite as guilty disappearing for half a day or something like that. But
and you've probably got a couple of Charles Tour events to play as well, have you?
I do, yeah. I mean, obviously talking about Rust earlier, going back to Abu Dhabi, I obviously not having really anything to play in the lead up other than the Whitford Pro-Am, so it'd be nice to play some four-rounders and just to try to stay sharp. Also I'm definitely playing at this stage Gulf Harbour and Mirawai.
And two good courses as well, I suppose, aren't they, for you?
They're a bit more like what we play on tour than some of the other courses.
Particularly if the wind blows.
Especially Mirawai. To be fair, I think Gulf Harbour is probably nastier in the wind than Mirawai.
Well, it's exposed to all winds, isn't it? Gulf Harbour, doesn't matter which direction it comes from.
You've probably got a bit more trouble at Gulf Harbour, to be honest. I think Mirawai, there's a couple of really tough tee shots, but Mirawai gives you a little bit of room if it's windy to kind of to use the wind or fight the wind and a little bit of room for error. But certainly Gulf Harbour, a couple of those tee shots get pretty stinky if it's really windy up there.
As a final thought here, Ryan, seeing we've got you in the studio, I suppose we should get a comment from Ryan about DeChambeau and his 300 as an attempt to drive. Did you see the attempt?
I did see the attempt to drive
the par 5 at wherever it was.
Yeah.
That one over the water.
Yeah. What do you see? What's he doing? Why does he hit the ball so far? Is it simple muscle power, or is there some technique involved as well?
I mean, I'm not 100% sold on what he's doing. I mean, it's impressive to change the mentality from picking up, from being sort of, I mean, not that he was average, but he was only slightly longer than average to then being the longest guy out there. But he's also found a niche in terms of equipment. He's using a 5-degree driver. I think his launch dynamics compared to
what do you use?
I've got mine's 8.5.
Okay, yeah.
And I think a degree is about 3 or 4 mile an hour ball speed. Yeah. So, but obviously and it's less spin, the less loft you have. But obviously, the less loft you have, the harder it is to get up in the air. So Bryson's doing everything way forward, teeing it really high. Mm. You know, he's completely changed everything to make that technology work, and he's found a gap in there where he can get a big gain A from equipment but B from speed. So I mean, the impressive thing is he's managing to hit it that hard and generally keep it on the planet.
But
for me, I think the focus has been far too much on how far he's hitting it, not everything else. I mean, you look at that US Open that he won at the back end of last year. His short game and his putting were incredible.
As they were last week at the Players.
Well, I heard, Saturday had 23 putts and didn't miss inside 20 feet? Yeah. I mean, that's almost unheard of.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
yeah.
Jordan Spieth 2015 material kind of thing. Mm. So I think that everyone's getting caught up in that he's hitting at miles, and yes, he is, but you know, there's been days where he's played with Rory or he's played with Matt Wolf or other guys who've generally consistently been as long, if not longer than him, because with the speed Bryson's generating, the spin rates are pretty hard to control and everything. So he, I think when he hits one, it's silly. When he doesn't quite get it, I think it spins up a little bit, it's quite hard to control, and there's other guys that are, even though it's not as fast, have a more optimal numbers and are actually hitting it further.
What do you think, what do you feel when you see him and you see what he's putting his body through with a swing, and I'm thinking, now this reminded me a bit of a guy called Tiger Woods when he was about 19 or 20 when he had this phenomenally violent kind of swing, and it was remarkable because he was hitting the ball further than anyone else and did all those wonderful things back in the 1990s. And
here we are, four back surgeries
and
later.
Now he's had all these surgeries and operations, and I'm wondering whether there's a danger that someone like Bryson DeChambeau putting his body through similar kind of pressure and tension might have problems down the road.
Yeah, I mean, I think Bryson's potentially gone at it from a different way. I mean, I don't know him personally at all, but, you know, you hear some, or listen to some of the interviews or read some of the interviews he's done, and he did the body thing first, made sure his body was right to be able to generate that speed. I mean, you can look at the golf swing and some of the positions that back and that knee gets into, and, you know, as you said, from what happened to Tiger, it just looks like that's going to happen again, but we won't know until it happens.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
I mean, I'm not trying to. I think what he's done is impressive. I don't think it's
great for golf.
I'm not trying to criticise him in terms of the distance side of things, but I think he's just getting too much. There's too much focus on that and not enough focus on the other stuff that he's doing really well, because the driving is. I mean, the old saying is drive for show, putt for dough, right? The driving is all show, and people obviously love the long ball, but what's winning him the tournaments isn't his long ball. It's his short game and his putting.
Didn't that apply to John Daly as well? Like when he won the Open Championship, you know, it was more of his short game that won that.
And that sort of gets glossed over, but you know, you go back 5 years, and when Jordan Spieth was winning everything, it was as part of it was winning everything. And Bryson's having, I mean, I don't think anyone's going to get to Spieth 2015 stats level, but Bryson, when he's been on and the weeks he's contended,
putting very
his
good.
Putting is
well, he played
incredible.
Played a couple of short shots at Sawgrass last week, which, you know, is around every green there's treachery, and the commentators were just left speechless how he could get the ball from an impossible position over the terrain and in the air and close to the pin, and he did it, and it's a sure sign that he's more than just bomb and gouge, isn't he?
I mean, he's found the mentality's hard to get, that he's gone from, you know, hitting it average to then all of a sudden jumping out of his shoes and really not worrying too much about where it's going to go. That's a hard place to get to, and full plaudits for him to be able to change that, because I think that's probably the hardest thing to change. The pickup of the speed, if done the right way, is doable. But to actually then go out and go from, I'm going to swing at it, I can swing it at 109, I can swing it at 135 in practice, but I'm only going to swing it at 120 in tournament mode. Like someone like Tony Finau is the opposite of that. You know, Tony probably got as much speed as Bryson if he really wants it, but if Tony really wants it, he has no idea where it's going to go. So he's got a much shorter swing, and he still generates plenty enough speed.
Interesting stuff, Ryan.
Very good.
We'll talk about this all day, but we better let you go and get back to your other responsibilities in life other than holding a golf club. But thank you for joining us again here on the tee, and we will be following you with a great deal of interest and closely throughout 2021, and hopefully you can get enough golf tournaments in. How many tournaments would you like to play this year?
I mean,
15 or 18?
No, I mean, at best case scenario would be in the mid-20s.
Oh, okay.
you know, obviously our schedule's pretty light now anyway, so it's pretty heavy from May through to November, and I certainly like to, you know, play a decent amount after not playing much last year, but
who knows?
There's too much to figure out at this point.
Exactly. So that's our lot for this week on the Tee. We'll be back again in a fortnight with another guest. In the meantime, we wish you well with your own golf. Thank you for joining us. And remember, our thanks also to our special friends at JK's World of Golf. Check them out at jksworldofgolf.co.nz. And the Akarana Golf Club, just 10 minutes from the airport and 10 minutes from the city. If you're in Auckland looking for a very good round of golf at a challenging course, check it out at akaranagolf.co.nz. Good stuff.
You've been listening to On the Tee, Golf New Zealand podcast, hosted by Tom Hyde and Brendan Telfer. Proudly presented by Podcasts New Zealand and Guerrilla Voice Media. You can find us online at podcasts.nz.